At this point in time, we're on record in Smith versus the State of Idaho Indemnity Fund. Matters before the court for oral argument. Mr. Star Kelso is representing Kevin Smith, the appellant, and on behalf of the State of Idaho's Industrial Special Indemnity Fund, Thomas Callery. Are there any preliminary matters?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir. You may proceed.
Thank you. Chief Justice, members of the court, years ago, a former partner of mine coined a phrase, or maybe borrowed it from somebody, I'm not sure, but it was the rule of Tuesdays. When something occurred that he couldn't explain, and a client asked him, well, why did that happen? And he said, well, what day of the week was it? Tuesday. Okay. Rule of Tuesdays. When I received the order of the commission in this case, adopting referee Harper's decision, Rule of Tuesdays couldn't explain that. Couldn't even explain what happened on the motion for reconsideration. Even when I worked on the briefing, I knew what happened, but I couldn't explain what happened. Why did this happen? I didn't know why. And I kind of felt like out on an island a little bit. Then, in October of last year, 2018, for some reason, I don't know why, particularly, other than generally I do read Industrial Commission decision cases, I came across the Walker versus Clear Springs Food case, which I augmented the record with the citation in reference to the pages. And I would like to read a little bit of it to you. Just, this is the commission's decision in July of 2018. And it's talking about the statute as to when a decision of the commission is final and when it's not. And so, beginning at page 20, paragraph 32, the court's current treatment of the issue of finality plainly instructs us to conclude that the December 9, 2016 decision is not final because it did not resolve all of the issues in the case. Then it goes on and references a Green versus Green decision in 2016 that I represented Mr. Green and Mr. Callery represented ISIF and Mr. Bailey was representing surety, and I didn't even just go because the fight was between the ISIF and the surety. But it talks about the Supreme Court stating that there's an apparent divergence between this court and the commission's understanding of the operation of Idaho Code Section 72718. And it clarified that final decision means final decision. All issues. So the commission goes on further, paragraph 33, says, so any, and underline, underscore, commission's decision, any decision made by the commission which does not dispose of a case in its entirety can be revisited by the parties or the commission until all issues in the case are resolved. Okay, so it knows the court's position. It says it right there. plainly. Commission goes on, quote, it is our conviction that this is an incorrect interpretation of Idaho Code Section 72718. We're right, Supreme Court's wrong.
They've made that very plain about that case many times.
The language of the statute is ambiguous only where reasonable minds might differ or be uncertain as to the meaning of the statute. And that shocked me. You can disagree, but essentially, as I read that, they're saying that the Supreme Court's unreasonable. And going on further, page 24. There is nothing in the plain language of Idaho Code, section 72718, which supports the court's view on finality. The interpretation is not found in statute. That was my answer. I knew what had happened. The Industrial Commission, when they decide they're going to do something, they can do something, and it doesn't matter what the law is, doesn't matter what the facts are. If they can write an opinion that disparages this court, they certainly don't have any problem trashing an injured worker who hasn't been back to work since his injury, since his surgery in 2007. Everything I've had to say about the law and the facts that occurred is set out in my brief, and I don't want to belabor the points in there. You either read the briefs and understand what took place, or you don't. Standing here and you know, making all sorts of gyrations with my arms or pounding on the table or whatever isn't going to convince you. You're all learned people who can read the English language to the extent that I may vary from it from time to time, and you can make up your decisions. I think it's clear that it should be reversed and Mr. Smith awarded benefits under the carry form. That's all I have.
Thank you, sir. Any questions? Sir, on behalf of the respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, good morning. Tom Callery again for the State of Idaho Industrial Special Indemnity Fund, and I always have a difficult time laying that out. I'm going to present my remarks as I see this case, and hopefully my remarks can be of some assistance to the court in this case. As the court's well aware, the Industrial Commission found that the claimant, Kevin Smith, was not totally and permanently disabled, either under the odd lot doctrine or 100% method. And that this court has ruled numerous times that that is a factual type finding on the issue of disability. And the question is whether or not the claimant met his burden to prove total and permanent disability. Our position is the Industrial Commission properly considered voluminous medical and vocational records in this case and made the decision that the evidence was simply insufficient to find this gentleman totally and permanently disabled. One of the issues in this case is Mr. Smith's lack of credibility, and both referees made findings that Mr. Smith had a propensity not to tell the truth, and that was underlined in both. This is an unusual case because it went to a hearing 8 or 9 years before our 2016 hearing. So we have two independent referees who made a finding that Mr. Smith lacked credibility because he made various misrepresentations to his medical treating providers and also to the vocational people. That was part and parcel why the commission did not find in favor of the claimant. The claimant's evidence in this case is basically his subjective statements that he cannot work, his subjective pain complaints.
So, Mr. Callery, I want to redirect the discussion. And one of the questions I had was, it looks as if Mr. Smith has a substantial psychological overlay that constitutes a significant impediment to his being employed, and that if he were to be treated for that psychological overlay, that he could overcome that impediment. But I didn't see any evidence in the record that suggested that his condition was treatable.
Was treated?
Was treatable. And I wasn't sure if I was missing something. I think the commission clearly concluded that there was a significant impediment. He couldn't return to work unless his psychological impediment were treated, and yet I didn't see any evidence that said that it was treated.
I would disagree with that. It appears the Idaho Department of Mental Health provided significant treatment to this gentleman when he was in an acute phase of depression, and he was hospitalized very briefly. Also,
at the time of the hearing, he was suffering from that psychological overlay, wasn't he?
Well, I think part of the evidence in this case is that the referee found that he was upbeat and hopeful at the time of the hearing, and one of the reasons why Mr. Smith lost this case is because of his demeanor and his overall presentation at the hearing in front of the referee, which frankly I think the referee found was inconsistent with someone in an acute phase of depression. In fact, Mr. Smith at the
time. You think that was a conclusion of the referee or of the commission?
Mr. Smith was hopeful and upbeat, and that's a factual finding by the referee that was adopted by the commission at the time of the hearing.
And how do we resolve the likewise conclusion that there's a psychological overlay that, without treatment, would prevent him from returning to work?
That is, those statements are very remote. They're from actually from 2000. Many of those are opinions from 2008 or 9. And the hearing was in 2016.
So we're to disregard the commission's conclusion that there was a psychological overlay, that without treatment he wouldn't return to work?
I think that a overall reading of the commission decision is that this gentleman had serious psychological issues, but I also believe that they felt it was treatable.
And I'm trying to find where in the record there was an opinion that said it's treatable.
I don't think any provider, there's nothing in the record where a medical provider or a psychological provider said, don't treat this gentleman, that this is a lost cause. In fact, he was prescribed various medications. There's some factors as to whether or not he complied with his medication. But he did obtain treatment over a long period of time, and nowhere in that record do they say this is an untreatable condition.
Well, there's a difference between untreatable and treatable, and doesn't there have to be medical evidence that it is treatable if he's otherwise unable to obtain employment without treatment?
I think the decision is that it's treatable. I agree with you that there's no specific statement where someone used the word, this gentleman is treatable, but I think a fair reading of the record is that all the doctors and all the professionals thought it was treatable without specifically stating that. That's my interpretation of the record.
Well, counsel, maybe I'd refresh your memory as to one of the findings at 84. In the findings of fact, it said that claimant psychological overlay is a significant disability, which if not treated would make it difficult for claimant to pursue employment. However, it does not appear from the record to be a permanent disability, but rather a treatable temporary condition.
That was certainly the finding of the commission, yes.
So has anything changed?
I think that the referee, as part and parcel of that, of the hearing and his decision, indicated that this person, that Mr. Smith, was not in an acute depressive state at the time of that hearing. This gentleman, and there's also the whole entire issue of what his mental state impact on this case is, and whether or not the ISIF has any liability with regard to his mental state. Our position is that the his psychological makeup does not qualify as a 332 pre-existing physical impairment. It wasn't a physical impairment at the time of the accident in 2007. And we're responsible for pre-existing, this gentleman's pre-existing condition as it existed immediately before an accident in 2007, not his mental makeup in at a later date.
You're not suggesting he didn't suffer from a physical impairment before 2007.
Well, he suffered from bilateral heel fractures, whether or not, and he worked as a plumber for 10 years after 1997 when he had a significant injury to his pre-existing impairment. But he had significant injuries in 1997. But I think the record does not demonstrate that that his heel condition was an impediment, was a serious hindrance or obstacle to his employment as a plumber, which he did successfully for 10 years.
But so he had to change careers. He was no longer able to pursue the career that he had before 1997 because of that injury.
Well, he changed careers.
He changed careers because he had that injury.
But plumbing, well,
that's certainly what the record suggests.
Plumbing is he admitted that he installed water heaters, that he installed sinks. This was he did not go from a heavy occupation to a light or a sedentary occupation. He did go from general construction to plumbing.
Because of the injury in 1997.
That was his testimony, yes.
Is there anything to rebut that?
There was evidence, well, no, I don't have anything I can specifically say to rebut that, because Frank, I can't. But he was released to only, actually, he was actually released to sedentary work by Dr. Tapper, his surgeon, or certainly light-duty work. I think one factor that you changed employment is one factor, but I think he successfully operated in plumbing, which is a medium to heavy duty occupation, for 10 years prior to this last accident. I would certainly say that our position in this case is that the pre-existing bilateral heel fractures do not combine with a relatively moderate wrist injury to render this gentleman totally and permanently disabled. That is our basic position in this case. I would briefly make some points.
But how do you factor in the mental condition?
Well, the mental condition, there's been a ruling that there was not that the wrist injury was not a predominant cause of the depression or the mental condition. And that's a 2008 ruling by the Industrial Commission that was not appealed, but that's part of the record in the law in this case. One could argue that his mental condition is a 72-430 personal circumstance that should be considered in overall disability. But the evidence that we have, I don't believe there's any evidence that he had a mental condition prior to his last industrial accident of such seriousness that was a hindrance and obstacle to his employment that combines with it, with the heel injury and combines with the wrist injury. This gentleman certainly had some psychological problems going back to childhood, and that's clear in the record.
So it's really the date focus that is set out in the, I'll say it wrong, the Colpair case that we've got to look at just prior to the industrial accident at issue.
I would agree, and I think that what makes this case more difficult is the fact that we have a ruling that says the psychological was not caused by the last industrial accident. I think that makes circling this case more difficult. Our position is that the this is not a personality style. It's not who the person is, but that this depression situation is, and I understand the court, some members of the court may disagree, but we believe it's treatable. And in fact, the evidence at the hearing, as the presentation by the claimant, actually would indicate that he is in a much better frame of mind after having testified at the hearing.
Is it fair to say that there's evidence in the record to support a finding that the industrial accident exacerbated the pre-existing mental condition?
Yes, I think there is some evidence of that. It was not the predominant cause, and I think the commission ruled that it was in part the acute depression that this gentleman underwent in 2008, and it was somewhat of a crisis situation. There is some evidence that the accident and being out of work contributed to that depressive state, and I think that's what the initial ruling was. It was a finding that it was not the predominant cause as required under Idaho law.
And what was the evidence to support that determination, that it was not the predominant cause? Walk me through what
well,
the commission found.
I didn't handle that case, but it appears to me it was largely based on Dr. Klein's testimony, who is a psychologist, that said that this gentleman had longstanding psychological issues that went back to a traumatic childhood. And I think that was the basis for it. There was some evidence in the record. This gentleman was discharged from the Army received a general discharge, not an honorable discharge. There's some history of getting into scuffles or fights with his employer, not physical fights, but some indication he got into fights with his employer or had a lot of short-term jobs. But that was, I think, overall that he had a difficult childhood and had some long-standing psychological issues prior to the 2007 accident.
What was Klein's testimony regarding the effect of the industrial accident?
He poo-pooed it, for lack of a better word. He thought that it wasn't as, he did not think it was a significant factor. There was a Dr. Renberg that was hired by the claimant who thought it was a predominant factor.
So we have two competing experts.
Yes. There's also, and I think these are somewhat side issues, there's also the excluded Exhibit 17 that I inadvertently didn't give as part and parcel of the Rule 10, which is a psychological report from California. I don't want to go into that in great detail. I think that there's tremendous amount of psychological evidence in the case, whether or not that's considered. Exhibit 16, which was William Jordan, the vocational expert's report, does refer to that and includes a synopsis of the excluded Exhibit 17. Exhibit 17 is a psychological report from California from an MD or a psychiatrist report from an MD. Industrial Commission Rules 10G does allow for self-authenticating of medical records that are signed and dated. So I think that the I certainly think that the expert witness, Mr. Jordan, could use that report as part of his opinion. We don't think that that was error. The commission did not consider that report in and of itself. There's also a functional capacity evaluation report that there was some dispute over, and whether or not the referee and the commission improperly interpreted that report. Our position is the report from California actually is the only evidence we have that's close in time to the hearing. It's a 2014 FCE report, and the referee used the various grip strength and range of motion testing. There was an unsigned portion of that report, but the referee did consider the actual raw data that was produced by the report. We don't think that's a Mazzone problem. The referee did not make a diagnosis or start looking at items outside of the record.
Just out of curiosity, I noticed that the FCE was done by a chiropractor, or appears anyway
yes.
to be a chiropractor. What is the standard for the qualifications of a person to do an FCE in Idaho?
I don't know off the top of my head. I've always seen a physical therapist do the FCE in the state of Idaho. I've never seen a chiropractor do one. But I can't quote that that's a requirement. I would note that that FCE was done at the request of the claimant. That is not a FCE that was requested by the Second Injury Fund or by the Industrial Commission. That was done for purposes of litigation. The position of the Second Injury Fund is that the claimant has failed to meet his burden of proof concerning being totally and permanently disabled based upon his pre-existing heel fractures and his wrist injury. We think the wrist injury, frankly, is rather modest wrist injury. It was a sprain and a lunate avulsion fracture that was properly treated by Dr. Jones in Coeur d'Alene. What we have with regard to the disability and inability to work from a physical standpoint is the claimant's own subjective statements concerning his pain and inability to use his left upper extremity. And I think that the commission and the referees, based upon his lack of credibility, did not give that a great weight, his own subjective statements. This gentleman is not 100% disabled. He's a relatively young man. He's in his 40s, and he's in a good labor market in Apple Valley, California, which has been testified in the record is approximately 90 miles from Los Angeles and is in near San Bernardino, California. He is also, in our position, not an odd lot worker. He did not attempt work. You know, there's three methods to obtain odd lot disability. There's no evidence in the record that this gentleman tried work and was unsuccessful at it. And after he relocated to California in 2012, the evidence is that he did not look for work, and our position is that it would not be futile for this gentleman to look for work based upon the medical evidence and the opinion of William Jordan. Interestingly enough, at the time of the hearing, Mr. Smith indicated that he had contacted Voc Rehab in California and was in the process just shortly before the hearing in 2016 of looking at that, getting their help in an attempt to return to work. And so Mr. Smith himself testified that he was hopeful that he would be able to return to the labor market, and that was the most up-to-date information we had concerning Mr. Smith's return to work, his own hopefulness and his opening up a file with Voc Rehab in California. In summary, we think this is a fairly straight.
Gallery, I don't think you got to the third test for the odd lot.
Well, the futile test.
Yes.
Our position is that this gentleman, his subjective complaints should be discounted concerning his inability to use his upper extremity.
Well, Brownell said he couldn't find work. There wasn't work available to him. And
well,
did Jordan identify work that was actually available in the labor market that he could perform?
He identified job categories that were...
Job categories. Did he identify any work that he could do?
Not specifically, but our position is he didn't... If the court finds that this gentleman met the odd lot standard, our position is we haven't rebutted that. But our position is that the odd lot standard has not been met, and we do not then have a burden to go forth with specific jobs. The evidence we believe in this case, both from the FCE itself. And this just gentleman's own testimony is that there are numerous jobs, as Mr. Jordan testified to, not specific, he didn't identify specific jobs, but there are numerous jobs in this California labor market that this gentleman can obtain. And Mr. Brownell indicated that if the FCE were believable, that the gentleman should be able to return to work. So it depends on... If you take the subjective complaints of the claimant, he will tell you he can't possibly go to work, or he did until the time of the hearing. His testimony at hearing was somewhat inconsistent with that. But subjectively, he indicated on numerous occasions he couldn't possibly go back to work. We would ask that the court affirm this decision. I thank you for your time.
How much time does the appellant have?
22 minutes.
Sir?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Very well. This matter is now under advisement. We'll render a decision.
I guess what is going to come out, huh? Right?